From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, for Father's Day, sons talk about their fathers. Comic Chris Elliott parodies the confessional tell-all biographies of celebrity parents who abused their children. Chris's father is Bob Elliott, who is half of the comedy team Bob and Ray. Then writer Ben Cheever tells us about editing a book of letters by his father, the late writer John Cheever, which revealed that his father was bisexual. Detective writer Walter Mosley shares some of the advice his father gave him about race. And Jim Gallopo, a probation officer who works with gangs in L.A. and used to be a juvenile delinquent, tells us how he turned his life around because of his father. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Batman Forever. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The computer software giant Microsoft and the Justice Department have won their court fight to settle an antitrust complaint. A federal appeals court has approved a settlement they reached a year ago. It had been challenged by a lower court. NPR's John Greenberg has details.
The settlement requires Microsoft, maker of the popular Windows program, to change its licensing agreements with personal computer manufacturers. For years, Microsoft required the manufacturers to pay a royalty for every computer they shipped. The Justice Department argued that arrangement stifled competition in the software industry. It took Justice Department and Microsoft lawyers months to hammer out the deal. Last February, they were shocked when a district judge rejected the settlement. The judge, who once worked for the Securities and Exchange Commission, said he could not determine if the deal was in the public interest. The Justice Department then joined forces with Microsoft to appeal the judge's decision. Today, their efforts were rewarded. The appeals court affirmed the benefits of the settlement and ruled the lower court judge had exceeded his authority. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
In the heaviest fighting around Sarajevo since the start of the war, the Bosnian army seems to be making progress in an offensive that began yesterday. Mike O'Connor reports from Sarajevo.
Intense shelling began before dawn in the hills around Sarajevo, but much of it was being fired at the Serbs. The government army appeared to be capitalizing on the gains it made yesterday when it was able to push in against the Serbs surrounding the city. Today, government troops followed the artillery barrage and seemed to move out of the city, hoping to cut supply lines, which allow the Serbs to keep heavy guns trained on Sarajevo. Serbs responded to the attacks with heavy artillery fire on government troops and on Sarajevo itself. A large apartment building near the office of the Bosnian president was badly damaged, and two patients in the city's main hospital were killed by a shell that exploded between their beds. For National Public Radio, this is Mike O'Connor in Sarajevo.
Britain and France vowed today to add rapid deployment forces to their peacekeeping contingents in Bosnia, although Republican congressional leaders say the U.S. must not be assessed a share of the cost. In Halifax, Canada today, President Clinton's spokesman says he expects the U.S. eventually to make a contribution, possibly in the form of materiel. British Prime Minister John Major said he understands Mr. Clinton would like to help pay, but has difficulties with Congress. Major also said nations participating in the UN force are in complete agreement on the need for a strong response to the escalation in fighting in Bosnia. Salt Lake City has won the Winter Olympics for the year 2002, beating out cities in Switzerland, Canada, and Sweden. The International Olympic Committee voted for Utah at a meeting today in Budapest, Hungary. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 12 points. The Nasdaq is up 5.5 points. This is NPR News. In Connecticut, the state attorney general is launching an investigation into an apparent hate message against blacks published this week in the Greenwich High School yearbook. Tondalea Wilder of Connecticut Public Radio reports.
The U.S. Justice Department is looking into the case, trying to determine whether any bias or other crimes were committed by five seniors at Greenwich High School. Officials say the students allegedly tacked a series of random-looking letters onto the end of yearbook photograph captions, spelling out a message of racial hatred. The words and letters appearing below the pictures of the five white students, when put together, contained a message about killing blacks. The five high school seniors were suspended in connection with the incident. State Attorney General Richard Blumenthal called the incident an outrageous expression of bigotry and bias. The Justice Department says it's prepared to help the Greenwich Public School System establish a program to prevent future incidents of racial bias. For National Public Radio, I'm Tondaleo Wilder in Stamford, Connecticut.
The Kremlin is talking about using force to break the grip of Chechen rebels on a southern Russian city. The rebels continue to hold as many as 2,000 hostages in a hospital in the town of Budyanovsk. Defense Minister Pavel Grachev says the hostage holders know they have no way to escape and are unlikely to surrender, so the use of force is the only way to free the captives. Russian officials say the commandos killed scores of civilians and police as they swept into the city and later killed five hostages in the hospital. Their demands include a complete pullout of Russian forces from Chechnya. The troops are putting down an independence movement that began 3 years ago. New Hampshire and Vermont experienced a rare earthquake today. The U.S. Geological Survey puts the magnitude at 3.8 and say it was centered about 10 miles southeast of St. Johnsbury, Vermont. No damage or injuries reported. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We celebrate Father's Day on this archive edition of our show. Comic Chris Elliott is the son of comic Bob Elliott. Chris has been a cast member of Saturday Night Live and is a former writer for The David Letterman Show, where he frequently appeared as the conspiracy guy and the panicky guy. Chris's persona is the impulsive oddball. His father, Bob, had a reserved and moderate persona as half of the comedy team Bob and Ray. In 1989, Chris played against his father's low-key image in a book called Daddy's Boy, a son's shocking account of life with his famous father. The book satirized all those confessional memoirs by the children of celebrities revealing how their parents secretly abused them. Chris Elliott let his father, Bob, write a rebuttal to each chapter. When Chris and Bob Elliott joined us in 1989, Chris read an excerpt called Birthday Hell, about a birthday party his father orchestrated for him, in which Chris was allowed to invite one of his classmates.
I was always a very shy little boy. I was scared of clowns, and I retreated violently from anything that smacked of audience participation. At a party, if a magician pulled me out of a group as his volunteer assistant, my body would immediately stiffen like a plank of wood, and my scalp would foam up with hot sweat. Anything like a sing-along would elicit the same reaction. I remember needing oxygen at Macy's after meeting Santa Claus, and once I told Ronald McDonald that I wished he was dead. So all in all, I was not a party boy, and no one knew this better than Daddy. Still, my sixth birthday was to be bigger and better than any before. Daddy filled our backyard with every conceivable form of audience participation known to man. Are you enjoying this so far, Dad?
Have you begun it?
There were clowns, mimes, jugglers, puppet shows, magicians, dancers, all eager to involve me in their acts. There were fashion shows, wrestling matches, and Graham Kerr, the Galloping Gourmet, gave a cooking demonstration. It was everything that I hated. I was allowed to invite only two of my classmates. The rest of the invitations went out to Daddy's friends. Among those who attended were Dick Cavett, Al Hirschfeld, and Jerry Vale. Not the most exciting group of playmates for a six-year-old kid. Dick Cavett bent my ear for an hour and a half about peanut butter. But for my dad, the party was a big success. As usual, the press was invited, the television networks set up their anchor booths around the yard, and the Happy Elliott Clan public relations machine shifted into high gear. Music filled the backyard. It was Steve Allen hogging the grand piano. Charles Kuralt wrestled Andy Rooney shirtless, and Art Buchwald rode the giant trained pig. At lunch, the big table was set, and I sat at the head of it, and we ate bean and bacon soup and filet mignon, blood rare, as usual. And the photographers snapped their shots of the privileged life of which the world was so envious.
Now, Chris Elliott, what are some of the books that you read to get in the spirit for this malicious tell-all book?
Well, sort of unfortunately.
I'm sure I've interviewed every one of the authors, by the way.
Probably. I guess I went back to see if there were any books like this, and I found that there were quite a few. Christina Crawford's Mommy Dearest was sort of a template for some of the stuff, and of course Gary Crosby's work about it, his dad, and B.D. Hyman's book. There's a little of that in this also. I must say, though, my dad's ignoring my chapters. I find that incredibly bumptious on his part.
Well, Bob, were you ever afraid that people would read this book and not get the joke and think that you were the kind of father as is described in the book? And,
no.
And that you forced Chris to dress like you and put on a bald wig?
Well, I don't know what that means. But
chapter three, Dad.
Oh.
You really haven't read the book.
No. I was never concerned because I thought I made my points perfectly clear. It was a chance to set down some ideas and thoughts I've had over the years and had no place to go with, and this seemed a real good spot.
Chris Elliott, when you were growing up, how aware of you were you of your father's comedy? Did you hear radio shows? The TV show was already over.
Yeah, the TV show was over, and I heard him on the radio. I was aware he was funny, but I assumed everybody else's dad was, too, and it never really occurred to me that no one else's dad had a radio show. He'd leave in the morning wearing a suit and a tie and carrying a briefcase. I'd hear his voice on the radio, and then he'd come back in the afternoon, but I never quite made the connection that he was a performer. I guess when I was about 10 and they had a Broadway show, I started to realize that he makes people laugh for a living and that maybe I could try to rip off the public that way also.
Did he do characters around the house?
No. It was a very normal, dull, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
Good word.
Childhood. There weren't, it wasn't like... a wacky, off-the-wall comedic lifestyle that we led. It was very dry-witted.
I think that really was the secret of Bob and Ray not being wacky or off-the-wall, although some of the material came off that way. But we were very kind of introspective and shy in a certain extent. And when we began radio, we were amusing ourselves.
You and Ray Goulding each started off as radio announcers.
Yes.
Before teaming up together. I think one of the sketches that you also became best known for, The Slow Talkers of America.
Yeah, well, all of those things developed later. They were ad-lib to begin with, though, but that was a big hit in our Broadway show in the 70s, and the Komodo Dragon Expert was another.
Would you say something about the speed of The Slow Talkers of America?
If you have time. I am Harlow P. Whitcomb. I am president and recording secretary of the S T O A. The Slow Talkers of America.
What was behind The Slow Talkers of America?
Just somebody that we had interviewed or seen or heard interviewed in the course of our activities as plain announcers, you know.
My guests are Bob and Chris Elliott. Bob is half of the comedy team of Bob and Ray. Chris, his son, is an Emmy Award-winning writer, and Chris has written a shocking account of life with his famous father, but he allowed Bob to write rebuttals to each chapter, and the book is titled Daddy's Boy. How did the process of writing this book together change your relationship at all?
No, I don't think it changed relationship any, really. We maintained a remote relationship while we were writing it, and we're leaving separately from here.
Yeah, it's the book tour that's changing it. We're really...
This being together is really terrible.
We're kind of just sick of each other, and it's just begun.
Chris, do you think there's any connection between the work you do now and the kind of comedy your father's done over the years?
I think there's a definite connection with the earlier stuff that my dad... and Ray did. You mentioned his 1952 television show. I just recently, a couple of years ago, looked at those tapes of that show. I had never seen them up until a couple of years ago. And I realized that back then, when he was about my age, I guess, if the jokes weren't the same as what I'm doing now, the attack on the idea was sort of the same. There was a lot of self-referential stuff, a lot of double reality stuff, breaking the reality of a sketch, etc. And that to me is very similar to what I've done for almost 8 years on Late Night and have thought for almost 8 years that I sort of came up with on my own. And I realized that I'm just have been ripping off my dad, and I think that show is different than what people generally now think of Bob and Ray as two guys in suits, you know, sitting doing sort of an interview parody type thing that they later became known for.
Comics Chris and Bob Elliott, recorded in 1989. There are parts of most parents' lives that are hidden from their children. In 1988, Ben Cheever wanted to learn more about his father, the late Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and short story writer John Cheever. So Ben edited a book of his father's letters. The collection includes John Cheever's letters to and about such literary figures as John Updike, Malcolm Cowley, Robert Penn Warren, Saul Bellow, and Philip Roth. There are also some very personal letters written to his wife and to the women and men who were his lovers. And for Ben, the most difficult revelation that came out of these letters was the extent of his father's homosexuality. I asked Ben Cheever to read one of his father's letters that was about father-son relationships. The letter was written to a man who was one of John Cheever's lovers.
Dear blank, comma, I'm truly sorry to hear about your father, and I'm much too old to have anything fresh or useful to say. I felt that I must strike some peace with my own father, although we both tried to kill one another. I made him into Leander and struck a useful peace after his death. I think you must do something of the sort. You must try to understand the man. I've told my own sons that when they find me lacking, they can continue to love me and find other men who will wear underwear, pitch no-hitters, and invent the telephone. It seems to work. I think I've known no man who has not accomplished this.
Did he, by the way, directly or indirectly, make that clear to you that when you found him lacking, to continue to love him and look for the traits that you were missing in other men?
Well, he did say that he had had many fathers and that I should try and have many fathers too. Interestingly enough, my relationship with him was sufficiently intense that I rarely had an older mentor, and I'm only beginning to make good friends with older men now that he's gone.
Were you afraid when you were going through the letters that your father wrote that you'd find information about how he felt about you, information that might surprise or disturb you? And did anything like that happen?
Well, I was afraid. It wasn't as clear as that. But yes, I think I was afraid that I would have to come to grips with things that would make me uncomfortable. And certainly I did. Part of the good news of my father's life is that he loved a lot of people. He loved a lot of people passionately. He loved a number of women, and he loved a number of men. This is good news, because he was also lonely sometimes, and I'm pleased to know that he loved all these people. At the same time, I'm not so big that I'm not a little jealous and a little hurt by the letters that he wrote to young men he loved. He was often very loving to me, but he was very passionately in love with some of these guys.
You know, in trying to think about, because I know that you say that the most disturbing revelation about the letters for you was the extent of his homosexuality, and it never occurred to me, but I see that now, that one of the things that would have disturbed you was a sense of jealousy that he had lovers who were probably around your age.
Well, that's right, and it's odd. I certainly wouldn't have wanted him to consummate his relationship with me in the way that he consummated his relationship with some of these other men. At the same time, it raises serious questions. I've been told by some of the men he was in love with that he would talk about me sometimes as someone who was physically attractive to him. I was completely unaware of this when it was going on because he was very stern in his public denial of bisexuality throughout most of his life. But it raises some interesting I wonder, because a lot of the time, the way he was, when he was angry at me, some of the time he was angry at me because I was a pest. I think all children are, having children of my own. But some of the time he was angry at me because he loved me. And I was just reading his journals, and there's an incident in which I went to pick blueberries. I guess I was 11 years old. And I don't even remember the friend I went to pick blueberries with. It wasn't someone I particularly liked. And I come back from picking blueberries, and he's sore at me because I haven't picked a lot of blueberries. Well, I didn't know why he was angry at me. Well, it turns out he was angry at me because he thought I was off in the woods with this other kid doing something unspeakable. Well, I wasn't, you know. I don't know what we did. We just didn't find a lot of blueberries. So that's very confusing for me. Where do you, playing back, when I play back my life, where was he, you know, what was love and what was hate? What was genuine disappointment and what was his projection of his own problems on me. It's hard to figure out. I'm sure it's hard for any son to figure out.
Were you jealous that attention he was paying to other lovers was attention that he could have been paying to members of his family?
Well, one of his lovers, who I talked with, and some of them, a couple of them have been very friendly and are friends, said that to me. He said, I felt that I was taking love from your father that maybe you or your sister or your mother could have had. And I really feel, and I say in the introduction, that you have to take the people you love pretty much the way you find them. You can't say, gee, he wouldn't have been wonderful if he'd never had a drink. Wouldn't have been wonderful if he'd never loved another man or another woman. Well, he wouldn't have been himself. And love isn't, it's not like marbles. You have three of them and you give one to, you give one to someone and then you don't have one to give to someone else. It's a mysterious thing, and I think probably his love, the love that he had from these people enriched his life, and the joy he got from it probably enriched mine. But I don't mean to say that, having come to this understanding, that I'm not capable of petty jealousies, and because I am. But I think when you really examine it, as I had to, you realize that any dramatic change in him would have also changed the man I loved in ways that might not have been fortunate.
My guest is Ben Cheever. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. To our 1988 interview with Ben Cheever, recorded after he edited a collection of letters by his father, the late writer John Cheever. Ben wrote the introduction to the book. Here's a short reading.
The introduction is titled The Man I Thought I Knew, and it begins. When my father stopped breathing, I tried to start his lungs again by blowing air through his lips. Then I put my arms around him. My mother and sister joined in the embrace. I could hear my sister and my mother crying, and then I could hear myself. We were standing at the end of the bed when the man from the funeral home arrived. All three faces were wet with tears. My father was naked except for a fresh white cast on one leg. He had taken a bad fall earlier in the week. His skin was pale and luminous like parchment, and I remember thinking that it looked as if it still had many years of wear in it.
I was wondering if it was very hard for you to write that, in the sense that I think when you're the son of a famous writer, that it's easy to feel in the shadow of your father, at least for a while, and to wonder, what would they think if they read this? And here you were actually describing the moment of his death. Was that hard to do?
Well, interestingly enough, this book wasn't hard in that way, because he wasn't here to write it, you know. If he'd been here to write his description, that would have been fine, and I wouldn't have tried. And I tried because he wasn't here. And I mean, the part I like best in the introduction is a little bit later on in the first page. The undertaker comes, and the undertaker is as I guess they usually are, he's rough with the body, you know, with his sacred body. And as he got ready to put it in his station wagon, I said, be careful with him or he'll bite you. And he turned to me and said, don't worry about me, I handled Rockefeller. And I said, but Rockefeller was dead. And I really felt, in working on this book, and I still feel very strongly, that my father is not dead, in the sense that I had always understood death before that afternoon. It may be that nobody dies in the way that, I know I sound like a crank spiritualist, but maybe I don't burn candles and I don't. But there were periods of time in my life when I didn't get along with him. There was a period of about 7 years when we only spoke in curt telegraphic sentences, and in many ways he was gone from me more then than he is now. it's of course it's changed for him. That's the hard part. It hasn't changed for me as much as it's changed for him. He can't write anymore. If he was alive, we'd be finding manuscripts somewhere. But I do think, you know, I run a lot, and I'll come around a bend in a park, and I really, honestly, will expect to see him there.
In your introduction, you, actually, in your preface, in your acknowledgments, you mentioned that your wife is going to learn something reading this, and that is that in one of your rages while writing the book, you actually broke the leg of the old wooden rocking chair and you glued it back together without telling her about any of this. And it made me wonder, what were those rages about when you were writing this book?
Well, I'm not sure what they were about. I think that, there was something that I was trying to consummate, and I'm still not sure whether I have or not. I'm trying to deal with what's happened to Daddy, and I'm trying to deal with the things that I'm trying to deal with missing him. I don't know how to explain it. When I would go, I would work on these letters for a couple of hours, and just sitting alone, I would type them into a computer, reading them, typing them. I would feel like he was around, because he's really there in the letters. You can smell him, you can taste him. I think even if you don't know him, certainly if you did. And then I'd get done, and I'd cry. First I thought, well, it's just because I miss him so much. And then the other day, my wife was writing something and wanted me to read her a line from a Houseman poem. So I looked up, it was To an Athlete Dying Young, I looked up the Houseman poem and read it to myself before I called her and read it to her. And I cried then, too. So maybe it's just the beauty. But yes, it was a very painful thing for me to do. It is my hope that this book will be useful for other people who want to do whatever they're doing, come to terms with their lives and their fathers. It's also my hope that finally it will have been useful to me. But hard, yes, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. I'm middle class, so I don't know hardship in the way that many people in the world do. But I've run a lot of marathons. I've certainly had lots of failures in my life. I've had a divorce. And nothing's been anything like as hard as this. And I'm not sure why. Maybe I didn't know that there was such a thing as death, and I had to deal with that. And maybe it has to do with the fact that I thought my father was the rock bed of my understanding of the world, because he was so candid and because he told such gorgeous stories, not just when he was writing, but when he was talking. And to have found that there was so much that I didn't know, didn't understand about him, has kind of shaken my faith. I hope to establish a new and more secure faith as the result of this work. I'm not sure I have yet.
Ben Cheever recorded in 1988 after he edited a collection of letters written by his father, the late writer John Cheever. Ben Cheever is also the author of the novels The Plagiarist and The Partisan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is a Bill Evans solo in memory of his father, Harry L. Evans.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on Fresh Air, more sons talk about their fathers. We hear from mystery writer Walter Mosley, actor Bruno Kirby, and probation officer Jim Gallopo. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Batman Forever. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. President Clinton says he hopes the U.S. will help fund the new Rapid Reaction Force for Bosnia, even though Republican congressional leaders say they won't provide any money. In Halifax, Canada today, the president said congressional leaders seem to object to the idea of the U.N. assessing member nations, including the U.S., for the cost of the force. Mr. Clinton says he thinks he can get Congress's approval for a voluntary rather than mandatory contribution.
We and others have made several voluntary contributions to the United Nations in the past for other important missions. I believe the United States should pay a share of this. I will support that, and I will do my dead-level best to argue that case in Congress.
Reports say the U.S., along with Britain and France, who are supplying most of the troops, will ask wealthy nations around the world to help pay for the expanded peacekeeping force in Bosnia. A federal appeals court has approved a controversial antitrust settlement the Justice Department worked out with Microsoft, the big computer software company. The government took months to negotiate the settlement with Microsoft, only to see it set aside by a federal judge who said it was inadequate. Now, an appeals court says that judge overstepped his authority and has ordered the lower court to approve the deal. It also has instructed the court to assign a different judge to the case. The Justice Department had filed a complaint that said Microsoft's contracts with personal computer makers tended to give the firm an unfair advantage in the market. They required the manufacturers to pay a royalty even on units that did not use Microsoft products. Under the agreement, Microsoft will change that licensing practice. Mayors from nearly 300 cities are holding their annual meeting in Miami. Jeff Bray reports for UPI.
The mayors are meeting through Tuesday to discuss issues of mutual concern, including proposed federal budget cuts, crime, AIDS, and immigration. They say this year's conference is especially critical, coming at a time when Congress plans to turn over more power and financial responsibility to state and local governments. Some fear that Republican plans to transform welfare funding into block grants will result in a loss of available money, and the cities will have to make up the difference. At least two Republican presidential hopefuls will meet with mayors, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole and former U.S. Education Secretary Lamar Alexander. Jeff Bray, Miami.
A Chechen commando has challenged Russian troops to storm a hospital where rebels are holding more than 1,000 hostages. The leader of the hostage takers says he has refused an offer of safe passage and the rebels will kill themselves and their hostages unless Russian troops leave Chechnya. The commandos have already killed 5 hostages. Russian officials say the rebels also killed scores of civilians and police when they stormed the town of Budyansk on Wednesday. Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow rose more than 14 points. This is NPR News in Washington. The United States says it regrets China's decision to recall its ambassador. Beijing apparently is angry at the U.S. for allowing the president of China's rival, Taiwan, to make a private visit last week. In the O.J. Simpson murder trial, it's been another day of testimony about the fit of a glove, and that followed a series of heated arguments away from the jury about whether the prosecution has been trying to dismiss jurors to force a mistrial. 10 jurors have been dismissed so far in the case, and just 2 alternates are left. Kitty Feldy of member station KCRW reports.
Prosecutor Marcia Clark labeled the defense allegations as groundless, saying she wanted a verdict from this jury, and hinted she'd be willing to proceed with fewer than 12 jurors. The defense has already said publicly it would accept a verdict from a smaller jury. Meanwhile, the prosecution tried to minimize the damage done to its case when O.J. Simpson showed the jury he could not completely squeeze his hands into the so-called bloody glove and its apparent mate. Glove expert Richard Rubin testified that the gloves in evidence had been soaked with a tremendous amount of liquid and had shrunk by 15%. Defense attorney Johnny Cochran suggested that the tremendous amount was just 3 cc's of blood, an amount Rubin said would cause no effect whatsoever. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy from the Criminal Courthouse in Los Angeles.
In the volatile West Bank town of Hebron today, a Jewish seminary student was stabbed, and Jewish settlers responded by going on a rampage through an outdoor market. The student was stabbed in the chest while he was on his way to pray at the Tomb of the Patriarchs. He's hospitalized in stable condition, and soldiers have been searching for his assailant. Settlers, angry at the attack, overturned stalls in an outdoor produce market. The attack came as Hebron seemed likely to be left out of the prospective agreement on Israeli troop withdrawals. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition for Father's Day, we're featuring sons talking about their fathers. Walter Mosley is the author of a series of mystery novels featuring Easy Rawlins, a black private detective from the Watts area of L.A. Mosley is one of President Clinton's favorite detective writers, and Jonathan Demme is filming one of Mosley's novels. The first Easy Rawlins novel was set in L.A. just after World War II, a world Mosley knew through his father. His father moved to L.A. after being raised in the South. Mosley's father was black, his mother white. When I spoke with Walter Mosley last year, after the publication of his novel Black Betty, I asked him to read the quote that opens the book called Ghetto Pedagogy.
This is a conversation I had with my father when I was a little boy. Ghetto Pedagogy. Dad? Yes. Why do black men always kill each other? Long pause. Practicing. I kind of like that. No, I was about 8 or 9, and my father had this, and I had this conversation.
So when your father said practice, what did that mean to you?
Well, that there was a lot of anger and rage in the black community, and it was aimed at people outside of the community, which people really couldn't exercise that rage on at that time. But they still had to exercise it, and so it was on each other. But it was, in a way, getting ready for something. Something that might not ever happen, but certainly it's getting ready for something.
Were you exposed to a lot of violence when you were growing up?
There was a lot of violence in the life. I don't think there's as much violence when I was a child as there is now. However, there was a lot of violence just in everyday life, just in the experience of everyday life. A lot of violence, a lot of anger, a lot of rage, a lot of despair. You know, I react more to psychological violence than physical violence. Physical violence is kind of easy to avoid or stay away from. But there's a kind of psychological violence in everyday life that black people and poor people in general experience in America.
What kind of psychological violence were you most exposed to growing up?
Well, just anger. You know, people who were angry all the time, people who were upset all the time, people who felt that other people were trying to take advantage of them, and sometimes they were right and sometimes they were wrong. Confrontations about everything, about how much something cost, about where you're going to go. I remember coming out of a restaurant with my father when I was, and my mother, when I was about, 12, and there was a valet parking, and so my father comes out and he gives the guy his ticket, and then another guy comes out after us, a white guy, and he gives the guy the ticket, and the guy goes directly to get the white guy's car and brings it back, and you know they get in, and my father goes up to the valet and he says, well, listen, you know, I want you to understand in a very loud voice, I'm not going to give you a tip, and I'm not giving you a tip because you went and got that man's car before you got my car, but I was first. Now I was 12. I was very embarrassed by this whole thing. But there, my father was angry. He needed to express that, so he needed to talk about what was happening to him. And I think that went on an awful lot when I was a child.
Do you think he was right in doing that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No question about it.
Now, your father grew up in the South. And, yeah. You're writing crime novels. There is violence in your books. Did your father tell you stories about the violence he was exposed to growing up in the segregated South?
One day, you know, it's hard to talk about the segregated South because it, even though that really is a definition of what went on with my father, it's broader than that in experience. One day my father sat me down and explained to me, or told me, every person he'd ever seen die. It was just amazing. Little children killing each other, black children, black people killing white people killing black people killing, everybody killing each other, people being hung, people dying because there was not proper protection on their jobs. And then he went to World War II. And he talked about all the people that he saw die in World War II, because he worked in statistics, so he typed up the names of everybody, all the Americans who had died. And finally, he came back to the South after that, and he found that all of his old friends, or most of his old friends who didn't go to war, had died also in, you know, these kind of petty and stupid little fights and arguments and from disease in the South. And so he moved to Los Angeles. And when my father, this took a long time to tell me all of these deaths. And at the end of it, he said, "So then, Walter, I came to L.A. and I knew I was finally free. I was in a land where these kind of things weren't going to happen anymore." And he sits down in a diner, and the guy next to him has a heart attack, keels over and falls on my father's lap.
Oh, no.
And dies. And it was a good way to end it, because it was a funny story. But also the idea of, you know, there's segregation, there's violence because of racism and from ignorance and poverty. But also, we all die. And I think that's what he was trying to tell me.
Walter Mosley recorded last year. His new novel, R.L.'s Dream, will be published in August. Actor Bruno Kirby is the co-star of such films as The Freshman, Good Morning Vietnam, When Harry Met Sally, and City Slickers. He was featured in the season finale of Homicide. When I spoke with him in 1990, he told me his father was an actor.
We're very, very close. We were born the same day. When I was born, I think my father just said, "Well, my best friend has arrived." And even though I was a kid, he would take me every place with him. He took me to Lee Strasberg's classes, and he'd say, "Sit down, just be quiet." He'd come home from work like 2 o'clock in the morning working as a waiter. He'd pick me up, he'd take me to 42nd Street, and we would watch Fellini films and Brando films. I was just a little kid, but we hung out together.
Did you like spending that much time with your father when you were young?
I loved it. It was sensational.
So did this get you excited about movies and about acting?
Well, you know what I think I saw? I looked at these actors, his friends, and I saw the camaraderie. I saw the stories, the way they would kid each other, put each other on, and I think I wanted to be part of it.
Was it helpful to have a father who was an actor, but not a father who was overwhelmingly famous, who you felt that you could never, ever live up to?
Well, I wouldn't know about the second part of it because, you know, I consider my dad to me knows more about acting than anybody I've ever met. He knows more about my acting than anyone. I mean, I remember when I was getting ready to do Good Morning Vietnam, I always give him my scripts and we always talk about my roles. I give him the Good Morning Vietnam script and we're going to shoot the film in Bangkok. So I go by his house to say, you know, to go over the script a little bit, but basically to say goodbye. It's the day before I leave. And I'm kind of running, you know, that kind of place you get when you're thinking about a trip, and he's talking to me about the character, and I'm just shaking my head, yes, 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 yes. And he says, "Okay, goodbye." I say, "Goodbye, Dad, I love you." And I start to leave, and he goes, "Wait, wait, wait, Bruno, one more thing." I said, "Yeah, Dad, what is it?" He said, "You know, I think this is the kind of character who would send jokes to Reader's Digest." And I said, "Yeah, okay, take care, I love you, goodbye." And I find myself on the set with Barry Levinson, and I say, "You know, Barry, I just want to say something here. I just want to say that, tell Robin that Reader's Digest is publishing 2 of my jokes." And Barry, because he's got his own kind of genius, says, "Okay, but they're just considering publishing 2 of your jokes."
Bruno Kirby recorded in 1990. One more story about a father after a break. This is Fresh Air. When we put together this Father's Day edition of Fresh Air, we knew we had to include a story told to us by Jim Gallipo. He's worked with Los Angeles gangs for close to 30 years. He's a probation officer with the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. Gallipo has an affinity for kids and gangs because he used to be like them. This is the story of how he turned his life around because of his father.
Well, I was a real delinquent when I was a kid. I was into stealing cars and fighting and breaking into liquor store warehouses and did commercial burglaries on music stores and, You know, I mean, I was just a fast kid. My mother had multiple sclerosis and was dying since my birth, and my father was a milling machinist at, you know, first at the Naval Shipyard in Long Beach and ultimately at Douglas Aircraft, and he worked a swing shift so he could, you know, take care of my mother. And when he'd even try to save his car by walking about 2 miles to a bus stop, taking a bus to Douglas, get there at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, come back, get back around 1 o'clock in the morning. They'd have to change my mother's total bed and wash her body and everything because she had defecated and urinated all over herself. And he'd get about 3 hours sleep, and then he'd have to get up, and he would get up and wake me up and cook me breakfast so he could be with me. You know, that's the only time we got to see each other. So I basically was on my own to do what I wanted to do all the time. And, you know, I just got into with a fast crowd and got into drugs and violence and, you know, all this kind of thing. And you know, he'd go out and go to work, and I'd sneak out his car. You know, go pick up my homeboys, pick up girls, go do all this kind of stuff, drinking, using marijuana, you know, all this stuff when I was real young. And I got arrested a lot. So ultimately, one time I came to jail as usual, and you know, they called my father at Douglas, and he'd have to, you know, after he got off work, he'd have to take a bus home, get in his car, and come down and get me out, which would usually be, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning or so. And you know, the cops were, and the probation officer was there at the time, where, you know, they were talking, you know, telling me what a punk I was and a little asshole and all that, and I'm telling them, you, and you know, we're gonna send you up, and I'm saying get down and do it. I ain't afraid of your jail. You know, I kind of look forward to going to camp because, you know, then that was a badge of honor, and I thought it might be a nice experience, you know, and I wasn't afraid physically, and you know, so I was in a repartee with the police and the probation officer, and they were angry, and I knew they were gonna send me up, and you know, I basically always been willing to you know, to be responsible for my own behavior that way. You know, I figure where I go, I'm, you know, I do what I'm ready to do the time. So here comes my father, and I'm like 6'1", I weigh about 230 pounds. In those days, I was, you know, a fairly good-sized kid, too. But, you know, my dad was like 5'3", you know, and my mother was like 5 feet. And they told him, you know, I would be a sickly, you know, child and all that. She could have had me aborted in 1942 when I was born. And, I mean, look how I turned out. Tells you the extent of medical science. But at any rate, so, you know, this man who never smoked, never drank, never womanized, all his whole social life was taking care of me and my mother. And they would go for rides when he didn't work. You know, they'd go for rides in the car, and that was his whole total existence. I was smart enough to realize at that time that I couldn't take care of my mother and without him. And the only prayer, I was raised Catholic, and the only prayer I ever said was, please, God, don't let this man die, you know, until I'm old enough that I could take care of my mother. And so here he came, you know, and I'd never seen the man cry. You know, he was quiet, gentle. You know, he was a man of extreme, you know, honor, but we were from New Hampshire, and we'd come out here when I was 10 years old, and we're French Canadians, they call us Canucks, and, you know, and he never knew anything about the kind of life that there would be when he came to Long Beach. He came because my mother was, you know, unable to tolerate the winters in New Hampshire, so he just asked him at the Navy Yard, hey, is there a warmer climate that's got a Navy Yard that would want a milling machinist? And they gave him a 2-week, you know, with pay and, you know, to go out to Long Beach, and, you know, he put everything we owned on a 40 Plymouth like the grapes of wrath. So anyway, he came in, and I, you know, at the time, it was an existential moment because I was, you know, cussing out the cops, and they were in the probation officer cussing me out. Here comes my father, and they tell him, Mr. Gallipo, you know, we're going to have to take your son away from you. You know, he's just, you can't control him. I know you've tried everything. We know your wife is sick, but we're going to have to put him someplace where, you know, because he's just too wild and all this. And all, you know, and I looked around and my father and winked and said, hey, them, you know, excuse me. You know, they ain't nothing. They can't hurt me. They put me in their camp. I'll be back out, no problem. And I looked at him, and he started crying. He just broke down physically and started sobbing. And I'd never seen this man. This man had been, without me knowing it, the strongest man I'd ever known. And to this date, he probably is. And I just, you know, I looked at him and realized I had done this to him. And he just broke down and started sobbing, telling, look, I'll get another job too. You know, I'll put him in a private school. I'll work all day and night to pay for it. Don't take him away. It'll kill his mother. It will kill his mother to put him, you know, away. Please don't do that. I'll do anything. I'll do anything. And all of a sudden, I realized the prayer I'm praying to God, you know, I am executing. You know, I am killing this man. I am killing this man. You know, and he's doing this kind of thing for me and my mother, and I'm out there killing him. So I just, then I turned around to them and said, hey, give me a chance, you know, and you ain't nothing, and you ain't shit, and you don't deserve to have a father like that. And I said, look, just give me one chance. Give me one chance. I'm not afraid to go to your jail, you know that, but please, I can't do this to them. I said, you give me a chance, and they did. They gave me 6 months to, you know, to straighten out my act, and, you know, I went to my little gang meeting, and told everybody, you know, that I was out, you know, that I loved them and that I loved the streets and the stuff we were doing, but that I just had to, you know, I explained the situation exactly as it occurred. And I mean, some of those guys cried, you know, and one guy came out with me. When I walked out of the meeting, he came out and said, hey, you know, my mother's a nurse, man. She's taking care of me and my sister alone, and I'm doing the same thing to her. He said, let's go get girlfriends. So, you know, I said, let's go down to the rich area and get girlfriends. And the next Saturday, we went down there and got girlfriends right away because we were like considered what they call hoods, and all the rich girls down at the beach, you know, were intrigued by us, and the surfer boys were afraid of us, you know, and all that. We just went down there and got girlfriends, and I didn't get arrested again until I was 18 years old.
Well, but you got arrested again when you were 18.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, I got good grades in school, and, right, you know, it was college material and all that. But that all happened at that moment because of my father, you know, and that changed my life.
Los Angeles probation officer Jim Gallopo, recorded in 1993. Happy Father's Day to all the fathers in our audience. We'll have more interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have about Bosnia?
Hi, Terry. Mike O'Connor reports from Sarajevo this evening, where the fighting between the Bosnian government and the Bosnian Serbs is becoming quite a bit more intense today. Even the hospital there was shelled. Salt Lake City, Utah, has won the right to hold the Winter Olympic Games in 2002. I'll talk with Howard Burkus in Salt Lake City. NPR's John Idstey reports from Halifax, Nova Scotia, where some world leaders have agreed on a plan to help the International Monetary Fund. Bob Mondello has a review of a movie about an Italian mail carrier. And speaking of Halifax, Nova Scotia, I'll talk with Laura Smith, a singer-songwriter, about the song My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's been a shakeup in Gotham City. For the third installment of the Batman movie series, Val Kilmer has taken over the role of the Caped Crusader from Michael Keaton, and the director of the last two Batman movies, Tim Burton, has been replaced by Joel Schumacher, who made The Client, Falling Down, Flatliners, and The Lost Boys. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Batman Forever.
If Bob Dole and William Bennett had just waited until the end of this summer, their gripe about violence in the movies might have become a moot point. Not so much because audiences would join them in their hand-wringing, but because the violence in this summer's movies is so tiresome. The endless chases and explosions in Die Hard with a Vengeance provoked mighty yawns. The futuristic shoot-em-ups in Johnny Mnemonic flattened what might have been an intriguing movie. And now there's Batman Forever. Watching it, you go through the six stages of bad movie entrapment: denial, anger, boredom, intense boredom, anger again, and, oh God, let me out of here. Preceding those stages, though, there's a brief period of delight, especially if, like me, you're predisposed to liking Batman movies in general, and Val Kilmer in particular. And sure enough, as things get underway, Kilmer proves to be a very sensual, soulful Batman, especially when he arrives at the scene of a vast robbery being committed by an evildoer named Two-Face. That's where Gotham City's police commissioner, played by Pat Hingle, introduces him to the beautiful and flirtatious Dr. Chase Meridian, played by Nicole Kidman.
Hot entrance. I'm Chase Meridian.
I asked Dr. Meridian to come to Gotham to consult on this case. She specializes in
abnormal psychology, multiple personalities. I read your work. Insightful. Naive, but insightful.
I'm flattered. Not every girl makes a superhero's night table.
Can we reason with him? He's holding innocent people up there.
It won't do any good. He'll slaughter them without thinking twice.
Agreed. A trauma powerful enough to create an alternate personality leaves the victim...
in a world where normal rules of right and wrong no longer apply.
Exactly.
Like you. Well, let's just say I could write a hell of a paper on a grown man who dresses like a flying rodent.
Bats aren't rodents, Dr. Meridian.
Really? I didn't know that. You are interesting.
Already you can hear a certain annoying stiffness in the movie's banter. At first you chalk it up to the comic book tone. After a while, it just sounds like a certain annoying stiffness in the movie's banter. But that's the least of this picture's problems. The script is nearly witless, and the actors are forced to deliver their lines at top volume and breakneck speed because they've got to compete with all the commotion going on around them. There's Tommy Lee Jones gobbling up the scenery as Two-Face, a former DA who has a split personality and a split face to go with it. There's Two-Face's partner in crime, the Riddler, played by Jim Carrey in his usual rubber-boned style. The Riddler has invented a machine for getting inside people's brains and sucking all the energy out of them. There's Robin, Batman's new sidekick, played by the saccharine Chris O'Donnell. And, like the two main criminals, he has a story that has to be related to us in mind-numbing detail and at very high speed. The movie's real star is the production design by Barbara Ling. It's lighter and brighter than anything in the two previous pictures, but it's also more stuffed with gaudy detail. And as if all that weren't busy enough, the director, Joel Schumacher, shoots his action scenes in quick, disjointed cuts so that we never know where we are or who's doing what. Since the characters are completely hollow, we don't much care. Batman Forever? No, it just feels that way.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Our Father's Day show is produced by Fred Landerl and Roberta Shurrock, who also directed today's show. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Hedrick Smith's new book, Rethinking America, a new game plan from the American innovators, schools, business, people, work. This is NPR, National Public Radio.